So tonight, I want to speak about probably one of the central teachings of the Buddha that I haven't ever seen any place else other than within the context of Buddhist teaching. And it's called the Five Aggregates of Clinging. This occurs somewhat in the teachings of Shankaracharya in the yoga world, but it's much more emphasized here in the Buddhist tradition. And the reason I say this is an important topic is there's a book called the Samyutta Nikaya, which I'll be reading from a lot later. Samyutta means collected. So these are the collected discourses. So these are like a collection of all the principal discourses on a particular topic. The collection that's the biggest is the collection on the five aggregates of clinging. There are in the Samyutta Nikaya 159 separate teachings. And this is pretty much partly it's how the Buddha taught. He taught for 40 years, right? So he didn't want to say the same thing over and over again. So he said, "Oh, wait, let's look at it this way. Let's look at it this way." He kept sort of the, China presented in different ways. I think also in different contexts to different people, he presented it in different contexts as well, and used different images. And so we're going to look at some of that. The interesting thing is this: the second largest collection in the Samyutta Nikaya is the teaching on the six sense bases. The five physical senses and mind, mental formations, being the considered the six. And in both of these teachings, what the emphasis is on is basically try and look at the world through this lens, through the sense lens of the six senses or through the five aggregates. Look at the world through this lens, and then notice two things. One, that everything's changing all the time, and that there's no self there. This is how the Buddha taught about no self in a quote practical way. Well, I'm putting practical in quotes, you notice, know, because this is with the six sense bases. It's like, yeah, we all know what the six sense bases are. We all experience tasting and smelling and all those sorts of things. The five aggregates, it's a different way of looking, very different way of looking at things. Anyhow, having said all that, I want to start. The word aggregates. In Pali, the word is khanda, and in Sanskrit, it's skanda. And both of these words literally translate as heaps. So this teaching, you could call the clinging to the five heaps of stuff. Might be, a more colloquial translation, but that's what he's basically done. In this is that let's take everything you experience and put it into one of these five heaps, and see that there's nothing left after you look. Everything you can think of goes into one of these five heaps without exception, and they're all changing all the time. That's sort of what it comes down to. So. But I want to read a couple of things here. First of all, I want to read this little thing from this is where he's trying to in this is from actually from Majjhima Nikaya, and he's actually talking to a bhikkhu, and he's trying to explain what the word aggregate means from more formal terms than mine, perhaps. Bhikkhus. Any kind of material form, whatever, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, this is the material form aggregate. And then he goes through and lists and does exactly the same thing for the other five aggregates. So he's trying to make sure it includes everything. There's no exceptions here. And that's the point he's trying to get across. And so in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness, This is one of what's called one of the aggregates, one of the dhammas, the fourth foundation of mindfulness, where this is like, as I said, this is like a let's you know that whole fourth section in the Satipatthana Sutta is saying, let's look at everything from this point of view and see what we can see. And so this is the actual words on the teaching from the Satipatthana Sutta. He knows such is material form, such its arising, such its passing away. Such is feeling or feeling tone, such its arising, such its passing away. Such is cognition, such its arising, such its passing away. Such are volitions, such their arising, such their passing away. Such is consciousness, such its arising, such its passing away. So that's the list of the five, and I'm going to go through that list several times. But here's the interesting thing. He's saying not only here are the five heaps, the five aggregates, but we're not only supposed to be able to see and be able to, in a sense, categorize everything we're experiencing and seeing how it falls into one of these five heaps, but we're also equally important to see that everything, that they're all arising and they're all passing away without exception. That's where he gets to the, in the end, he gets to this concept of not self, because there's no self left. There's no, nothing there you can call a self when you look, see these are just five heaps of stuff that's changing all the time. Okay. So what are the five aggregates? This is now we're going to get down to the details. And the first of these is, and I'm going to go through this, like I said, several times. First of these is material form. So anything, literally anything. You know, now it's in, as in two separate words. Anything that we can, you know, whether anything, and it's not only the thing itself, but the experience of that thing. So it's like, anything we experience through our five physical senses. Okay. So that's the whole first thing. So that's a big heap. That's everything material, right? Then the next one is called Vedana. Vedana, the Pali word, translated, you'll see in his teaching, you'll see it translated as feeling. Trouble with that word is it sort of has that sense of, oh, I have feelings about this. You know, it has a sort of an emotional content. But Vedana is much simpler than that. Vedana basically has three flavors. You know, it's a called, you know, the translation is feeling tone is the translation you'll see used a lot in this tradition. And basically, Vedana is only one of three things. It's pleasant. It's unpleasant, it's neutral. Or they say neither pleasant nor unpleasant. That's all that is. And the thing about Vedana is there's something, some material form, and we experience it in some way. It comes into our recognition. And the first thing that always arises at that point is Vedana. The first mental formation, the first wave of mental formation when we experience anything, anything, is Vedana. And Vedana is always pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. That's it. So it's this really simple thing. But the importance of this is, and this is, you'll see this in other parts of other teachings, because Vedana keeps occurring in other places in the Buddhist teachings, is that initial hit of mental formation right after we experience something sort of gets us to go towards our habitual patterns. When something is pleasant, we want more. When it's unpleasant, we want it to go away. And when it's neutral, we space out. And so that's, but it's just, that's, it's a really pure, simple little bit of mental formation that's always there with every experience. Everything we experience, Vedana is always there. The thing about Vedana is it sort of gets missed because it's quite instantaneous and subtle. I'll talk more about that later too. Then comes what he called cognition in his translation. Also, you see this translated as perception. Something arises, vedana arises, and then perception, the mental formation of perception or cognition. So it's basically we identify what that thing is in some simple way. You know, it's like I hear a sound, vedana arises, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and then it's like, oh, dog barking. That's perception. Perception is categorizing the experience in some way. And this also always occurs. So there's something arise, something arising, something, then there's vedana, then there's perception, which is the simplest form of mental process, because it's just we have this these categories of experience that we, you know, when we're born, right, we don't know nothing. Like a little baby doesn't have much perception going on because there's no categories there yet. That's why babies look like totally blissed out all the time, because they're not caught up in all this stuff yet. They're just like, you know, I mean, eventually they perceive, you know, oh, nipple. You know, they get to know a few things, mother's face. They get to have a few standard perceptions, but at first they have nothing. So they have there's no mental process going on there. It's all just automatic physical process going on. Anyhow, perception. Then mental formations. And this basically means all other mental formations other than vedana and perception, which have been separated out because they're so important. And he's trying to show the sequence of how things happen. So mental formations, especially intentions or what's sometimes called volitions. You know, and sometimes people explain there's like an intention arises to do something, and the volition is the process of making that intention happen, actually the physical process and mental process. Like I have to think, oh, I'd like to raise my arm. And then it's the whole mental process of actually raising the arm that has to go on. There's a lot of mental processes to stick my arm up in the air going on there. And that's volition. So there's intention, which is the start of it. And then there's volition, which is keeps going. It's one way to think of it. And he separates those two out often, and in some teachings they'll only talk about those two because they lead to all other mental formations. They're the thing that if something's going to arise at a mental level where we start to think about the fact that I heard a dog and found it unpleasant, whatever, you know, all those other things have happened, then I'm, you know, my intention might be to, you know, go throw a stone at the dog, or it might go to pet the dog. Who knows? It depends on you and how you feel about dogs and that particular dog and all that sort of stuff. So intention and volition might be very different all the time. It's always changing, just like these other things are. And then the fifth key is consciousness, the knowing faculty, the knowing of things, which is all these other things had to happen before we could know it. Capital K, know, perhaps. and I'm going to talk more about that as well. But I just want to go back and emphasize one thing. By seeing, I mean, and this is where the Buddha keeps, why he has 159 teachings on it, because it's like, here's 159 different ways you might understand this. By seeing that everything fits into one of these heaps, that there's nothing left out, there's no exceptions, that everything is just arising and passing away, and something else arises and passing away, that's all that's ever going on, then it becomes clear when you start to know that, not on the intellectual level, but on the experiential level, that there's no one home. There's no I there. There's no separate thing that's standing back experiencing all of this. It's all just, it's pure process. going on all the time. And basically that our sense of being separate is totally delusional. Because we can't find, when we start to look, we can't find an I or a me or a my or a mine, or there, because there's nothing solid. That's why they're called the five aggregates of clinging, because we keep clinging to the idea of this separate I based on this process that the five aggregates describe. Okay, let's move on. So now I'm going to move on into the Samyutta Nikaya. It's a big fat book here. And you can see I got little labels sticking out of the top because I got six different time things I want to say out of here. So I want to go to label number one. And here he's talking to a householder, and he's teaching him about the aggregates. And then this is, how, householder, is one afflicted in body and afflicted in mind? Here, householder, the uninstructed worldling, that's a word the Buddha see in the text that means us, us uninstructed worldlings, someone who isn't a realized being, who is not a seer of the noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, who is not a seer of superior persons and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, regards form as self or self as possessing form, or form as in self, or self as in form. So four different ways, and he's being very precise, these are four different ways where we fall into selfing. We say that form, that I possess that form, or that form possesses me, I'm in that form, or as form as, so he's just trying to point out all the different ways we get caught believing somehow that this form is a separate me. And he uses this language, and you see this language in many places in the suttas. I want to read this little bit again, just that regards form as self, or self as possessing form, or form as in self, or self as in form. So there's like four different ways you could think about things and make them, turn them into a sense of self somehow or other. He lives obsessed by the notions, I am form, form is mine. As he lives obsessed by these notions, that form of his changes and alters. With the change and alteration of form, there arises in him sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. So what he's pointing to here is, you know, we solidify around this sense of self as being something fixed and solid and permanent, and then it changes. Because it always is, because everything's changing, but it's becomes quite evident in our physical form. You know, we might, any of you might have noticed somehow that your form is a little different than, say, in your 20s, or even in my case, your 60s. It's just like, keeps changing all the time. It never, and because we thought we had this idea that somehow, no, I'm going to keep this 20-year-old body forever. That's who I am. I've solidified around that. Then this is what causes sorrow and lamentation. In other words, this is how suffering arises. It's how we create our own suffering by believing that this form, this material object, is solid and permanent, as opposed to something that's just something that's in the process of change all the time. Okay, so that's the first thing he says, and that language, that list of the four different ways of looking at form and self, Is something you'll see in other places and Buddhist teachings, many places. Okay, so let's look a little more closely at this list of five. So material form, one way to look at it is anything that can be affected by external conditions, heat and cold, wet and dry, etc. So anything that can be affected by external conditions is a thing. Good, interesting definition. And also the sensation of those things. Like, for instance, we'll have a sensation of something arises at one of the sense doors. We have a sensation. And what we do, how we create self out of this, is we then put on top of that pure sensation some concept, like my nose is itchy. All we experienced was itch or itching. And we turn it into my nose is itchy. And so I got two layers. I got the concept of nose. I got laid that on top of that sensation. And I got the concept of my nose. So I've added two layers of concept on top of just pure sensation. This is how we self. Create self around physical sensation because we categorize it and make it into something personal as opposed to just raw, pure sensation, which is actually all it is. This is some arising at the one of the sense doors that's gonna be gone just like that, probably. Even maybe a nose itches for a minute, but it's got it's, even if it, like, it no even if it itches for a minute, the thing about all of these sensations, and you may have noticed if you start to watch, there's something arising. It might be something really annoying, like an itch, or it might be something really pleasant. And then at some point, something else has arisen at one of the sense doors that catches your attention more than that itch, and the itch is essentially gone. It's gone. It's like that. It's just because your mind is now someplace else, is paying attention at some other to other something else. Now that thing that you'd made so permanent, my nose is itchy, is just not there anymore. It's like you didn't have a nose, let alone an itch. It's gone. That's just the nature of how things work. Okay, I want to read something from Joseph Goldstein here about this too. And he's talking with this idea of concept. This is a more profound instruction than we might first initially realize. He's talking with the instructions in the Satipatthana Sutta, because it leads us from the level of concept, body, head, chest, arm, leg, foot, to the level of direct experience. We may think that we're feeling the foot or leg, but there's no sensation called foot. It is only when we go past the concept to what we're actually feeling that we can apply the next instruction. Here one knows this is material form, such its arising, such its passing away. As long as we're stuck in the world of concepts, we're not understanding that it's just raw sensation and that it's arising and it's passing away. We don't see that. Because we're sort of stuck at the mental level of conceptualizing my foot. He goes on. One of the most deluding aspects of concepts is the concepts themselves don't change. We use the same words, head, body, man, woman, whether it's today, yesterday, or tomorrow. The words remain the same, which reinforces the illusion that there is something permanent that these words refer to. So when it's very deeply in our languaging about things that we create this sense of permanence, because the word is the same word for something that's totally changed and is changing constantly. Yet when we contemplate the first aggregate of material elements, we clearly experience their changing nature. All of these sensations are in constant flux and change. But we, with the concepts we lay on top of those sensations, we create this sense of solidity and permanence, which, of course, makes us want them to stay that way. And we get disappointed when they're not. Okay. So that's one thing Joseph has to say. I want to go on to feeling tone, Vedana. And basically, I have notes here. I want to read the notes. So, any rise in a material form at one of the sense doors is followed by Vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Here's the key point, however. What Vedana arises is not dependent on the object, but on causes and conditions just before that arising. My old teacher, Swami Vishnu Devananda, used to use this. This is a classic teaching thing he used to do. He said, think of the favorite thing you have to eat. Whatever it is, it might be, Haagen-Dazs coffee ice cream, or it might be a bowl of rice with a nice little bit of pickle on it. Who knows? I mean, everybody's got their own taste, right? But imagine that I just gave you a bowl of that and said, eat, enjoy. And if, sure enough, you put that first spoon of that stuff that's your favorite thing in your mouth, and oh, is this ever pleasant? I mean, the Vedana of that moment is, of that sensation, of that first spoon of your favorite thing, is going to be pleasant, guaranteed. And it's probably going to stay pretty pleasant through many spoonfuls, maybe even the whole bowl, right? But by the end of the bowl, it's like, okay. And then just as you finish that bowl of stuff, I say, here's another bowl. Eat it. Same stuff. Nothing has changed except now you've already had a bowl. And it's like, oh boy, I get seconds. This is great. And about halfway through the second bowl, though, it's like, oh, now it's getting sort of lost its glamour. And it's like, sort of, now it's sort of, the Vedana is pretty much like neutral. It's like, oh, it's okay. I'll eat this. I mean, this is my favorite stuff. I should eat it. He gave it to me. He's a nice guy. I should eat it. You finish that second bowl. And then sure enough, what doesn't it happen? I hand you a third bowl. And all of a sudden, you look at it and you go, oh, God. More Haagen-Dazs coffee ice cream. What? And the Vedana is totally unpleasant. Same object. Object hasn't changed. All that's changed is what preceded, the causes and conditions that preceded you receiving that sensation. But we conflate Vedana with objects all the time. We think, oh, Haagen-Dazs coffee ice cream, it's always going to be pleasant. Which, if we just get a little bowl full, probably most, but even then, like some days you're going to go, it's like, oh God, I just don't feel like ice cream. It could be the first bowl where the Vedana isn't pleasant. But we think somehow that these things are bound together, that there's a permanent connection between this mental arising called Vedana and that particular object. Another way we get confused, in other words, because we think then we get a bowl of Haagen-Dazs coffee ice cream, our favorite thing, and it's like, and we experience the Vedana, like, ugh, and then we go, oh, must be something wrong with me. How come I'm not excited about getting this ice cream? Or whatever it is, right? Notice I'm using ice cream all the time, you know what my favorite thing is, but actually, now it's a coconut stuff, no more dairy. I'm being a good vegan that I am. Anyhow, so that's the thing. It's like, that's the problem with Vedana is it literally isn't solid. We think it's solid, but it keeps changing all the time based on what happened just before. It's conditional, as they say. Then we have perception, which is the next level of this, right? I put the bowl of ice cream in front of you. You get that immediate pleasant, unpleasant, neutral hit of mental formation. And then you go, oh, look, it's ice cream. That's perception, right? So there's the process of labeling what has arisen based on past experience. Problem with perception is terribly inaccurate because it's we just think we understand, we think we know what it is, but it's just like something that just arose. And we often misperceive, but we all think we're really good at it. We all think, this I've a friend who's a police officer, and he says the biggest problem with getting witness statements and where there's a lot of witnesses to something is you'll get five different descriptions of the guy who did it. It'll be totally different. It'll be tall, short, fat, thin. It'll be different skin color and wearing different colored clothes. Everything will be different depending on the person who perceived it and their own biases. Our perception is totally colored by our own private biases about how things are and who should do things and not. Joseph has another take on this as well. When we don't observe the five aggregates carefully, there's one deeply habituated perception that we have around the world and ourselves that becomes the origin of many inaccurate conclusions. It's a perception that keeps us from understanding what is true. This is the perception of we have of the solidity of things. We believe in the solidity of material phenomena, in the solidity and stability of relationships, of societies. But as long as this perception of solidity and stability is fixed, we don't deeply understand the impermanent and insubstantial nature of all phenomena. Why is this perception of solidity so strongly conditioned in our view of reality? One reason is the rapidity of the changes taking place. Things are moving so quickly, we don't see the discontinuities. For example, when we go to the movies, we don't see the separate frames of the film. They are moving quickly enough across the screen that all the images flow seamlessly into one another. Or when we see an electric light, we see the light as continuous rather than as a flow of electrons through the filament. Another reason we don't see the insubstantial nature of phenomena is because we are usually observing things from a distance and so not seeing their composite nature. If you look at a hillside from a distance, all you see is a mass of color. As we become closer, we begin to see individual trees, then parts of trees, and then on a cellular or molecular level, no trees at all. On this level, the perception of solidity, even of tree, has disappeared. This is the same with all objects of experience. They seem solid only from our limited perspective. For this reason, the view of solidity is called a hallucination of perception. We think it's solid, we think it's permanent, and it never is. Nothing. But I mean, I'm sitting here. This desk seems pretty solid and permanent to me. But maybe it'll be 100 years from now, but this will just be a bunch of garbage molecules. Oh, this is a pretty cheap desk, so maybe it'll only be 50 years. I mean, who knows? You see what I'm getting at here. Okay. Then so that's the third one, perception and cognition. All and then we have mental formations, the fourth one. The problem of selfing is most obvious when we look at how we use language around these mental formations. We may make a sense of I by the language we use mentally or verbally around these mental formations as they arise. Thinking, for instance, think of emotions. I am happy. I am sad. These are like we added in the I because of our habits of how we express things, once again, how we use language. Instead, and I'm not saying happiness and sadness don't exist. They're mental formations, of course they exist, but it's the I part. So instead, what we can, and this is an actual practice suggestion if you want to try this sometime, or be aware of that, trying this as much as you can. Instead, try and say, mentally have the wording around it, happiness has arisen, or sadness has arisen. Doesn't need to be an I there. The I is additional. We stick it on top of the experience. We make it solid and belonging to someone. And this helps us to see the impermanent, insubstantial nature of all these mental states. They're all just arising and passing away. Every mental state we have. I mean, we're never permanently sad or happy or any of those things. They're just things that arise, they're there for a while, and then they're gone. And by not making them personal, we tend to not cling to them and self-identify with them so strongly. They also, as I mentioned, they often in the text, they'll separate out volition or intention. And the reasoning behind that is because they're particularly important in the process of I making. And because of the idea, I'm in charge. There's an I that's in charge of all this, that is creating this intentional process of one volitional thing happening and then another and then another, that somehow there's an I that's in charge of all that. That's and it's like this is just totally delusional. Stuff is just happening. And there doesn't need to be an I there. An intention arises and a volitional process occurs without there having to be a separate I involved in all of that. And I'll come back to this more, don't worry. Number five, consciousness. That which knows that somehow some there's some at some layer of mental process. There's something that knows these other four levels are going on. That sort of, it seems like ties them all together. This is where we identify with this aggregate because it seems so continuous. It seems like, well, there's always this consciousness is always there. But actually, this isn't true. What happens is there'll be a tiny moment of consciousness that arises when something arises at one of the sense doors. Then we go through this process of Vedana and perception and mental formation around it. And consciousness is now aware of that. But then something else arises, and a different layer of consciousness is paying attention to that. Because there might be, the Buddha talks about it, and he talks about eye consciousness versus ear consciousness versus tongue consciousness, different sense organs. There's different layers of consciousness, sort of one happening after the other, but they're all sort of separate moments of mental process. It seems continuous because, we're having 20 sense perceptions a second, so it seems pretty continuous. But in actuality, when you can look deeply, you see that they're just a moment of this and a moment of this and a moment of this and some of this consciousness and this kind of this. That's all that's ever going on. There's no solid self behind all that. It's just this consciousness, mental function of consciousness is just occurring naturally based on the fact that the other four layers of stuff have happened. then we become conscious of it. And all of that is just based totally on causes and conditions such that that thing arose and we became conscious of it. Even there, I just use the word we because the language is so, it's like consciousness arose of that particular thing because all the other steps were there. But that's all. But we cling to that consciousness, that layer of consciousness as being, that's where, if I've got an eye anyplace, it's there. We think, that's the important one. I gotta have gotta be a separate me there someplace. And I'll talk more about that later as well, because it's a topic that comes up. But I wanna actually look at some various other things here that are in the Samyutta Nikaya. So now I gotta go to number two. And this is the classic image that you see over and over in the Buddhist teachings about a flowing stream. You know, what the Buddha is trying to get across with this image over and over again is that basically all that's really ever happening is there's this constant stream of things arising and passing away that we're embedded in. We're part of that stream, but we're part of that stream that has some consciousness, for lack of a better term. This is the image he put. Bhikkhu, suppose there was a mountain river sweeping downwards, flowing into the distance with a swift current. If on either bank of the river, kasa grass or kusa grass were to grow, it would overhang it. If rushes, reeds, or trees were to grow, they would overhang it. If a man being carried along by the current should grasp the grass, it would break off, and he would thereby meet with calamity and disaster. If he should grasp the trees, they would break off, and he would thereby meet with calamity and disaster. So there we are, floating down this stream, and we kind of grab onto things that are a part of the stream, essentially on the edges of the stream, and stop the process. Like, I want to stop being in the stream. I'm going to hold on to this stuff, and that's called clinging, right? We're clinging to this stuff, and then it breaks, and we pull off into the stream again. This is why we suffer. Because this is the image he's trying to get across. It's the clinging to the stuff. It's trying to somehow stop the process. Stop this. I want to get off. But we can't, because we're an integral part of the stream all the time. And every time we try and stop and make something solid and permanent, all we're doing is setting ourselves up to suffer yet again, because it's going to break. And there we are, pouring down the stream again. Without fail, this is going to happen. So that's one image I wanted to get across here. This is where the Buddha says that what we should do about the five aggregates. Here's how we should handle this. And he sums it up quite simply. He says, Bhikkhus, whatever is not yours, abandon it. When you have abandoned it, it will lead to your welfare and happiness. And what is it, Bhikkhus, that is not yours? Form is not yours. Abandon it. When you've abandoned it, it will lead to your welfare and happiness. Feeling tone is not yours. Perception is not yours. And it goes through all five aggregates. When you have abandoned it, it will lead to your welfare and happiness. What he's saying is, all we have to do, he says casually, is abandon this idea that these things are somehow solid and permanent. that there's an I in there that these, when we put all these heaps together, somehow there's an I in the middle of all that. The key word here is abandon. Now, I actually looked this up in the dictionary. And abandon in the dictionary says, give up completely a course of action, a practice, or a way of thinking. Give up completely. We have to abandon our habits of clinging to the aggregates. That's the solution, he says. Like I said casually, yeah, but to do that, we have to be able to see the aggregates first. We have to see, somehow take that in, and not as a mental concept, but as that's what we're actually experiencing. Everything we're experiencing all the time is just something in one of the five aggregates catching our attention. That's all that's ever going on. Okay. So now we have, that was number three. Now we're going to number four here. No, I'm on the wrong page. Sorry. Too many pages here. Ah, yes, here we go. And this is the Buddha's talking to some senior disciple. And he says, but Venerable Sir, this is the disciple talking, what is the cause and condition for the defilement of beings? In other words, why do we keep suffering? Why do we keep getting caught in this clinging to the aggregates? How is it that beings are defiled with cause and condition? If this form were exclusively suffering, immersed in suffering, steeped in suffering, and if we're not also steeped in pleasure, beings would not become enamored with it. If there was only suffering, this wouldn't happen. But because there's pleasant things arising as well, that's why we get enamored by form. If we didn't have a favorite kind of thing we like to eat, but because form is pleasurable, immersed in pleasure, steeped in pleasure, and it is not steeped only in suffering, beings become enamored with it. By being enamored with it, they are captivated by it. And by being captivated by it, they are caught in suffering. He's pointing out that there is both pleasure and pain. There's one stuff that we want more of and stuff we don't want at all. If it was only stuff we never, if the world was made up of stuff we never wanted, we would never have to worry about it. But because there's this balance, the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows, that's, and we get confused by that because it's some of this and some of that, and we keep thinking that somehow we can balance it out to only have the good stuff and none of the bad stuff. And that's what, of course, causes us to suffer. Ah, yes. This is the next one. This is, here is, this is another thing the Buddha often does. He gives a set of similes that represent the five different, in this case, the five different khandhas. Bhikkhu, suppose there is that this river Ganges was carrying along a great lump of foam. A man with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to him to be void, hollow, and insubstantial. For what substance could there be in a lump of foam? So too, bhikkhus, whatever kind of form there is, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, a bhikkhu inspects it, ponders it, and carefully investigates it, and it would appear to him to be void, hollow, and insubstantial. So he's saying, what he's saying is all form, the image around all everything in the form world is like a lump of foam floating on the river, which is something we can all understand. It's like, yeah, I've seen, and we know we see a lump of foam, it's like, well, that'll last for a while and then it'll be gone, right? That's just the nature of foam on the river, right? Then he goes on. So suppose, because that in the autumn, when it is raining and big raindrops are falling, a water bubble arises and bursts on the surface of the water. This is Vedna. It's like, you've seen rain and you see a drop of water hit and it's like, there's a little thing and it's gone just like that and just disappears. It's totally impermanent. That's an image for Vedna. It's like, it's happening. Sure enough, every raindrops makes a little thing happening on the face of the water, but it's gone just like that. This is the nature of Vedna. But it's an interesting image because we all once again have seen raindrops falling on a pool of water. Then he goes on. I'm not going to read all the text here. He calls perception a mirage. Seems real and solid until we see through it. Perception is like, it seems like we're seeing something really solid and it's there, but it's just a mirage. It's just a mental mirage that we've created around the solidity of that thing. Then for mental formations, he uses the image of a plantain tree. Now for us Westerners, what the hell is, why is that a good image? Because a plantain tree has no heartwood. It's all bark and no wood. It's just there, sort of, but there's no solidity to it at its core at all, ever. But it seems, externally, it's quite solid. People in India would understand it right away, right? And then consciousness, he calls it a magician's trick. It seems, because the magician is so skillful, that there's something there. But it's when you see how the magician does something, it's like, oh, nothing really there at all. There's no magic to it at all. It's totally insubstantial. Those are just images he likes to use. Okay, we're moving along here. One, I'm just trying to give you a sampling of what the Buddha says about all this stuff. This is the last one from the Samyutta Nikaya. Here, Bhikkhu, the uninstructed worldling becomes frightened over an unfrightening matter. For this is frightening to the uninstructed worldling. It might not be. It might not be or for me. It will be or it won't be for me. So we're talking about how we get caught up in, is that there or not there? Is this true or not true? Is this solid or not solid? And for the uninstructed noble disciple does not become frightened over an unfrightening matter. So what he's getting at here, and this is quite important, I think, is the problem with the concept of not self. It scares the hell out of us. It's like, what do you mean there's no self? Because if there's no self, well, who am I? What am I? Becomes there. It's a scary idea. That, and because it's so scary, we don't want to go there. We don't want to think about it. Don't want to know about it. Don't want to figure it. It's like, I certainly don't want to experience it. I don't want to experience not having a self. Thank you very much. Because if I don't have a self, what the heck am I anyway? Right? Joseph has a good image for this. And he's talking about this very idea. It doesn't take too long to get a beginning sense that appearances arising in consciousness are not self. Because we see how they just keep coming and going. This is sort of where meditation practice can go, is, initially, when we're practicing mindfulness, we get really strongly pay we're strongly paying attention to what the all the little events that are occurring, right? But at a certain point, we step back from that event consciousness to a sense of just paying attention to the process that underlies it all, and we start to see that things are arising and passing away, and that's all that's ever going on. That's what we actually are aware of as we're meditating. That's the sort of the layer. We see that we're down a layer from the top level of sense, things happening at the horizon at the sense doors, because we start to see this, they're all the same. I mean, they seem really different. You know, that's a pain in my knee and my nose itches and that weird thought just came. But that's just things that are arising and passing away, and we start to experience at that level. That's what he's getting at here. A subtle identification can still take place, however, with the knowing faculty itself. Oh, this is the sense of consciousness. I'm the one who's knowing all these changing objects. We might believe the knowing is I, is self, because knowing or consciousness is much more subtle than other arising objects. We might find it difficult at first to be mindful of it. Actually be mindful of being aware. Can you be mindful of consciousness? But as the mind's power of steadiness, stillness, and clarity grows stronger, we can actually become aware of awareness. At certain stages of meditation practice, it becomes clear that consciousness itself is a changing process. This discovery can be an unsettling because for so long we have identified with the faculty of knowing as being most essentially who we are, taking it to be our soul, our self, our center. And now we see that it too, just like all the other phenomena, continuously appears and passes away. And then he gives this great image. Imagine yourself dropping out of an airplane and free falling for the first few minutes. Imagine the sense of exhilaration. But then you realize that you do not have a parachute. So you panic as you fall through space, falling, 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 filled with terror that you do not have a parachute, till at a certain moment arrives when you realize that there is no ground. At that point of understanding, you just enjoy the ride. That's what he's talking about. He's talking about literally there's no ground and no need for a parachute and no need to have that strong feeling of a separate self being that what consciousness is. That's I love this image just because we can all imagine it. You know, jumping out of an airplane. Ah, isn't that great? And then, oops, forgot my parachute. Didn't need one. Going to finish with a little bit of poetry, of course. This is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In. It's one of her shortest, simplest poems. It talks about this sense of no, of not self quite precisely in a way. It's called Touch Me. Touch me as if you seek to find the core of my desire. Come to me like wind before a summer storm, blown open, I close no doors against the breeze. Dance with me beneath the low clouds. Find me within you, above you, beside you. When the rain finally falls, I cannot tell where you end and I begin. No separation. That's another way of saying not self, is that there is no separation between this and that anywhere, ever. And she's talking about the bliss of that feeling.
Or so they tell me.
So, hopefully, I've at least given you some food for thought here. I won't pretend for a minute that I grasp all this and I've experienced it all and know this all to be absolutely true. It just seems to me that the Buddha kept talking about this so much because it's so important. This is like the central teaching of Buddhism, this whole sense of not self. And it's somehow we have to at least start grasping it intellectually, and then over time we'll have little experiences where, oh, you'll be, I've had this experience of sitting and then noticing, oh, there's no body here, no body at all. There's just consciousness itself, no body, no sense experience going on at all. Oh, and it's like, oh, wait, this is what they were talking about when they were talking about, it's like, you start to associate the knowledge with the experience. They start to coalesce somehow. And I've had little tiny tastes of that, but there's a lot more. I have a lot more practice to do before I really know all this stuff in my, at the level of practice and understanding. But the reason I like this teaching is it makes sense. To me, I can understand this on an intellectual level, and it's sort of like, yeah, this all makes sense. It's an interesting way to describe things that I can see because I've experienced all those things. I've experienced physical phenomena, I've experienced vedana, I've experienced perception, I've experienced cognition and intention, I've experienced consciousness of being aware of awareness. Yeah. Now I just have to sort of integrate it more somehow. And that's just more practice. So that's all I have to say about this topic. It's been a lot to say, I realize, but that's okay. So now, as always, I will open the floor to people who have questions or comments or just thoughts. And if I've totally worn you out, that's okay. Don't feel at all obliged to say anything. I just wanted to offer that opportunity if you're so inclined.